drugs,
rape, quality of life,
recovery, harm reduction,
advocacy,
policy, treatment,
stigma.
Drugs Uncut, the Scottish Drugs Forum podcast.
So hello and welcome to the Scottish Drugs Forum's podcast, Drugs Uncut. My name is Julie Heslin-McCartney. I'm the Director of Operations here at Scottish Drugs Forum. I'm joined by two of my colleagues for today's episode.
I am Austin Smith and I am the Policy Officer at Scottish Drugs Forum. And today is our special guest, a very special guest, is our colleague Adrian. Do you want to introduce yourself, Adrian?
Thanks, Austin and Julie. Yeah, I'm Adrian Hannah, and this is my last day at SDF. I'm retiring today after 11 and a half years working in SDF.
A good bit of service there with SDF.
We say our emotional goodbyes. As if you've taken your leave of your working life, we could reflect a wee bit on what you've been doing most recently at Scottish Drugs Forum, which in your post, which you've been in for how long?
11 and a half years.
11 and a half years?
Yes.
So it's
almost exactly 11 and a half years, yeah.
A lot to reflect on. So where would you like to begin? I suppose that what might be interesting is to reflect on how this post came about and how it was initially funded and what the initial intentions were.
Back in 2011, we had the quality development team in SDF out working in services. And what they were hearing time and again was that people in services weren't getting any information about sexual health and very little information about bloodborne viruses. And about that time, the Scottish Government were producing their sexual health and bloodborne virus framework. And it seemed like a good time. I wasn't at SDF at the time, but I'm imagining that what happened was they decided it would be quite good to get someone in who could do a bit of training for staff working with people who use drugs, to train up the staff to the point where they would feel comfortable actually talking about stuff around sexual health. And so, yeah, my post was created. And at the time, I was doing various bits of training around these topics, but I remember that Nikki Coya from Greater Glasgow sent me an email and said, Adrian, Scottish Drugs Forum have just advertised a post that you absolutely need to apply for. It is just made for you. And then a couple of other people actually sent me exactly the same message. So I applied and was very happy to be appointed.
So, yeah, so in those, it seems like ancient history now, I suppose, but the issues are the same for people who have a drug problem and are maybe engaged with services around the drug treatment. Sexual health, certainly at that time, was seen as a separate issue from your drug problem. And for some people, those parts of their life are quite intimately connected,
yep.
But in service land, they're two different things. And interestingly, and I suppose you can reflect on this later on, in terms of funding, they're separate in the sense that the different parts of government would deal with, yep, with drug treatment, even though it's moved over to public health now.
Yeah, absolutely. They were always kind of seen as separate, I think. And when I first started in SDF, I had what I thought was a wonderful idea of getting staff working in sexual health services to speak to staff working in drug services, and they could kind of learn from each other. And it just didn't work. And I think it was about lack of comfort and lack of knowledge about the two different subjects. So I kind of expected that people working in sexual health would know about issues around drug use, and people working in drug services would know about issues around sexual health, and they just didn't. And that has changed so much in the last 12 years. You quite often would now get groups of sexual health staff and drug service staff together talking about these subjects, but at that time you just didn't. So it took me a wee while to kind of figure out what the training course I was going to deliver would look like. So a lot of the early work really was working with staff who are supporting people who use drugs. And I had to really find a way in to talk about this subject, to make them feel comfortable about talking about the subject. So I always started with the law around sex. And that's such a head thing. And it was all about facts. And some people would come and they'd know a lot of stuff, or they'd think they'd know. They think they'd know the age of consent. They think they'd know the law about selling or exchanging sex. But in actual fact, in our discussions, they would learn from each other and from me, and they would have some factual information. But it was a way to get them to start talking and thinking about, okay, how do we actually talk to our service users about some of these difficult topics? So kind of getting them to feel a wee bit comfortable about that subject. I would then do stuff around giving them information about contraception, about sexually transmitted infections and bloodborne viruses. So a lot of background information about sexual health. And then we would get on to sex and drugs. So what impact do different drugs have on your sexual health? And we do stuff about values and attitudes, and particularly around different people who might be using services. So the whole LGBTQI plus community using services, but maybe keeping their sexual orientation under wraps, because that would be quite challenging in those days to be using a drug service and be open about your sexual orientation or your gender identity for that matter. So I think it took me a wee while to kind of settle in and just find what was going to be right in terms of training and what was going to be comfortable, and not just jumping in at the deep end and expecting that people would be able to talk about what are very still very challenging topics. So that's kind of where I started.
No, it's interesting. And reflecting myself, I suppose, I was obviously there when this work started. In fact, I was in the early meetings about the funding and the funding bid, which I can remember well. But I suppose SDF reflected the field in that time, so we didn't consider sexual health as part of a core business, as it were. So, I mean, I think that your post and you, if I can say, as a post holder, have helped transform SDF's thinking around that stuff and the connection with sexual health and with the LGBTQI communities, and just about the whole way in which people's sexual behaviours can be linked to their substance use and vice versa. And the complexity of that is something that has a profile across the staff team that it certainly didn't have when you joined Scottish Drugs Forum.
Could I maybe reflect in there about my experiences of attending one of Adrian's training courses back when I was a service provider? So working for a third sector organisation in Edinburgh, Turning Point Scotland, and we had arranged for SDF to conduct some sexual health training for us. And Adrian and I have had this chat really recently where I've reflected back that I attended one of Adrian's courses and the impact that had on me and my knowledge and my awareness and understanding of just why sexual health is so important when it comes to delivering services for people who are using substances. And I think it's fair to say it had quite a dramatic impact on the way that we spoke to service users about their sexual health, about their confidence within their sexual health, and our ability to really, I guess, adequately assess people's needs and help them to either signpost to sexual health services, to have confident conversations about contraception and looking after your body. And that did have a real big impact. So I can absolutely reflect why at one point it wasn't considered as particularly important as part of a service provider's work in terms of providing drug treatment services. But how after the training it was like, wow, why hadn't we thought about this before? It makes such sense. So it had a real impact on the way we delivered services. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Julie. Thank you for that. I think kind of jumping forward a little bit, I think if you look at the latest Scottish Government Sexual Health and Bloodborne Virus Action Plan and what they want to cover and what their priorities are, they are so similar to what we were doing in those early days of HIV. And if I can say, I mean, the work there, they want to talk about, for example, postpartum contraception. And when I started at SDF, Mary Hepburn was still part of our board. And she was so forward thinking in terms of this and in terms of working with women who were using drugs and getting them to consider contraception after they had delivered children. And here's work. This is work that's still ongoing, and Scottish Government are still seeing how important it is. Following on, so we've got the whole training bit, and I'm working out how that's going. And then around about 2014, so this would be a couple of years into the post, we undertook some peer-led research in North Ayrshire with women who were using or not using drug services. And the research really, really was trying to find out, why is it that men who have got drug problems will almost immediately access services, whereas women who've got drug problems wait until absolutely the last possible moment to access a service. And in a way, we found something that we probably already knew, and we have heard this time and time again since then. And that is about children, women and children, and women terrified that their children will be removed from their care. And if they seek help from a drug service. And what that did was reminded me of work when I worked for Aberlour Childcare Trust with Joy Barlow at the time. And we had a drug rehab for women and their children. So it was very innovative in that we were working with families. And it was very much about a recovery model, though. It was very much about women stopping using and having their children there with them in this residential rehab. And many women stick out for me, but there was one woman in particular who had six children removed from her care. Two of them had already been adopted. Four of them, and I use this term, freed for adoption. Even that term is so stigmatizing, isn't it? You're freeing those children for adoption. Anyway, four of them were in that process. And she was with Aberlour and she was pregnant again. And I remember somebody from public health saying to me, why on earth doesn't she just use contraception? You know, just no understanding that what this woman wanted was to have a child, to be able to keep her child and to be supported in doing that. And I think we have learned so much about working with women and their children now. And we know that that is what works, that women who use drugs can still be excellent parents and may also need some support. But actually removing children from their parents rarely, rarely benefits the child or the mother or the father for that, from that point of view. So that was really interesting. And it was kind of linking up for me previous work that I had done within drug services. And I think it's really good that we've moved on from that model of you've got to be abstinent in order to be a good parent. We now know that that isn't the case.
And also, hopefully, we've moved on from the notion that somebody would ask a worker a question like that and not think to ask the person themselves.
Yes.
And also ask the worker that, presuming the worker won't know the answer to that either.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, I think we definitely have, haven't we? I wanted to mention a couple of people, actually, because when I started in SDF, Biba Brand was the person running the quality development team. Yeah. And I've stayed in touch with her over many years. And she has been amazing in terms, especially in terms of working with women. And Bruce Thompson as well. He came to SDF, I think, sometime after I started. But I knew him also from Aberlour, as I knew Biba. So you know, people are following each other, aren't they? So, which is quite nice to reconnect with people. I suppose after 2014, if I can just move on, sure. Is that all right? We then had the HIV outbreak in Glasgow starting in 2015, or we became aware of it in 2015. And I remember my colleague Emma coming into SDF and saying, do you know that there's an HIV outbreak? And I think I actually remember crying at the time, and probably tears of rage. And I think you were there as well, Austin, at the time, thinking, how could this have happened? And my history, going back again, one of my very first jobs was working in the early days of HIV and working primarily with gay and bisexual men who have sex with men who are affected by HIV, but not exclusively that group, people who were using drugs at the same time. But we seem to have got things right for people who use drugs quite early on in terms of what's now called IEP, needle exchange at that time. So how come in 2015 we could actually have ended up with an HIV outbreak amongst people who use drugs? I just was floored by this. And I began to really reflect, because by then I'd have been in SDF for 3 years, I think. And I was thinking, have I talked enough about HIV in my training? Have I forgotten to mention this? Is this, you know, and I really was questioning myself about, have I covered this? And I know that I did talk about it, but maybe I didn't talk about it enough. Maybe it kind of slipped off the agenda a little bit. And then suddenly we were faced with people who were homeless, who had a history of being in prison. And this was the big difference, that this was a group of people traditionally who would have injected heroin, who are now injecting cocaine. And that was the big difference. And I think we know fairly certainly now that that was the main reason why HIV spread so quickly amongst this population, because we had a group of people who were probably using IEPs, but probably not getting enough equipment for the number of times they'd be injecting cocaine compared to the number of times they were injecting heroin. And the other thing was, cocaine has a big effect on your sex life. You're much more likely to be having sex if you're using cocaine than if you're using heroin. So here we are again, beginning to talk about sexual well-being in this particular population.
And some of that, I remember at that time going out as a kind of third choice or fourth choice, being taken off the bench to use a football metaphor, because we were busy, so busy doing briefings for staff. So these would have been, the ones that I dealt with would have been people who were in offering supported accommodation to people who were homeless. So the outbreak obviously was in amongst that group. So the priority was to go out to services and give them very simple messages around HIV, how HIV is transmitted, how people can be tested, and what the treatment looks like. And what shocked me was, and I'm not a sexual health expert, but what shocked me was that the awareness amongst those kind of staff was basically the thinking that would have been presented, you'd have seen in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. It was that this a diagnosis was a death sentence, that it would be very hard to tell somebody they had HIV, or even to suggest to someone they get tested, because the news of their diagnosis would set them back in terms of any progress we're making with their drug use or the stability mm-hmm. in the rest of their life. And so the understanding about treatment and was almost zero among some staff. I have to say it was some staff, but you wouldn't do a briefing where there wasn't some people in the room who would voice that, and then you were starting at the very beginning of explaining that.
Yeah, absolutely. And people seem to be just as terrified of HIV and AIDS as they were back in the 80s, because they were still holding on to all of that misinformation that had never been righted in any way. Nobody had been given the correct information. And in fact, just over a year ago, I met a young guy who was begging in Glasgow, and stopped to chat to him. And he said to me, now he didn't know me at all, but he said to me, I've just been tested for HIV, I'm waiting for my result. And I felt as though he was kind of saying it to me, like, I wonder how she's going to react. Obviously, I was fine about it, but I just said, that must be really hard, waiting for that result. And he said, yes, I actually tried to take my own life last week because I felt it would be better for my family if they thought I had died from suicide rather than from AIDS, using his language. So the information about the new information, not even very new now, but the up-to-date information about HIV isn't getting to that population of people who are potentially at risk. So they don't know about things like U equals U, undetectable equals untransmittable. You know, if you're on treatment, even if you've got HIV, if you take your treatment, you cannot pass HIV on sexually. They don't know about PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis. If you've been at risk, you can take something that will stop you from getting HIV, or PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis. If you know you're going to be at risk, you can stop, you can make sure that you don't become infected. So that kind of information is just, I mean, it is getting out to people who are at risk in this particular population, but it's probably not getting there as quickly as it needs to. And a lot of that population, as I said, are still holding on to information that they got in the 80s. In fact, people come in my training courses, they weren't even born in the 80s, and they know about these things. Yeah. It's fascinating to me how that misinformation is still there and people are still holding on to that.
Yeah, it has its own viral transmission.
It's absolutely. Isn't it? Yeah.
And also, I suspect the motivations for workers to give full disclosure about information isn't there, in the sense that you're encouraging people not to share injecting equipment. And so the threat of HIV, you know, you don't then say you may contract to HIV, but if you did, it's not as the death sentence you might imagine.
Exactly.
So the motivation for workers is mixed,
Yeah. And again, you've got to talk about sex. Mm. You know, that's the thing. So that's still a bit of a challenge. So 2019, 2020, myself, Louise Bowman, Leslie Bourne, Katie McLeod, Katrina Matheson worked with us at that time as well, in taking part in some research, which was around understanding the sexual health and bloodborne virus risk behaviours of three particular groups. So men who have sex with men, gay, bisexual men involved in chemsex, so quite a new term at that time. And the other populations were people who are selling or exchanging sex. In the end, in the event, we actually, I think there was only one man who came forward for within that particular group. So it was mainly women we interviewed. And then people involved in using iPEDs, image and performance enhancing drugs. And that research, I think, was really interesting and led, again, to quite a lot of training. So it really informed us about chemsex. So here, this was a population which was quite different from the traditional group of people who use drugs that STF would normally have been working with, who STF would be used to working with, if you like. So this was a group of men who have sex with men who were involved in something called chemsex. I mean, if you even just think of the term, using chems rather than drugs. They would talk about slamming rather than injecting. So it's a way almost of distancing yourself from drug use. But they were men who were putting themselves at risk sexually and through using drugs and injecting drugs. And a huge amount of information needed to be given out for people to keep themselves safe, and particularly around harm reduction. And I think what that research showed was it really helped us understand the risk behaviours of that particular population. And then the women who were selling or exchanging sex that we spoke to, again, a surprising number, I say surprising number, probably not surprising at all, but women whose children had been removed from their care and then ended up selling or exchanging sex. So women who were using drugs, children removed from their care, and then they would end up involved in this. And so again, understanding their risk behaviours and how to keep them safe without any judgment of how they were actually making money, getting drugs, whatever. It wasn't about that. It was very much about harm reduction for them. And then the group of people using iPads, again, who would not see themselves as drug users at all, and yet potentially could be at risk of bloodborne viruses, possibly STIs as well. That was interesting, I think. And more recently, what I'm hearing is that services set up for people who do use iPads, those services are now being used by people who are transgender, so trans men primarily, who are injecting testosterone, are using iPad services. So interesting, isn't it, how it's all kind of linked, sex and drugs, and, you know, one way or another, and gender as well, of course, in there. So I think as well, that research really, really informed the training we were delivering at that time. We started working with Terence Higgins Trust and delivering chemsex training. That was mainly Leslie who did that. And Louise and I, and Leslie to a certain extent, also involved in women and drug use, and trying to get staff really thinking about what the risk behaviours were for women and thinking about harm reduction. And in a way, I'm jumping about a bit, but I think if you look again at what the latest action plan is from the government, the priority areas are still all these priority areas we've been talking about, STIs and BBVs, all the stuff about contraception, LARC, long acting reversible contraception, postpartum contraception, etc., HCV, HIV, all the stuff around bloodborne viruses. But generally, it's about sexual well-being. And I think that's what we've always tried to do in SDF. We've tried to look at the sexual well-being of people who use drugs. That's kind of always been the theme, I hope. And I suppose around, so this is 2020, we were doing our research. And I think then leading into COVID, lockdown, the pandemic, things changed in terms of our training. And we were working with Leon Wiley at that time as well, looking at young people and how young people were, their risks around drug use and sexual health were hugely increasing around this time. I think I'm right in saying that's when we really began to see things changing. And Louise particularly was very involved in looking at social media and looking at how young people were now getting their information. It was so difficult to access sexual health services. And if you wanted information about sexual health, you went online. And we know there's a lot of misinformation online, but we also know there's a lot of good information there that people are sharing. Even more recently, just hearing about young people learning from pornography about sex. And in some ways, that's good. There's good information there, but there's some pretty awful information there as well. So Louise and I started looking at how can we deliver a training course around young people, sex and drugs. And we looked at things like child pornography. We looked at grooming, how young people were involved in being groomed around sexual exploitation and criminal exploitation. And so we've got a course which kind of, it picks up on some of the early information in our early training around the law, for example, because the law has changed and it's had to change and adapt. Things like sharing what would be considered to be an explicit image of someone under the age of 18 is still illegal, even if it's you yourself and you're under the age of 18 and you're sharing something, a bit, you know, a picture of your own body, that is still illegal, and young people don't really realise that. And certainly if they then share that information with other young people, that's further considered to be further child exploitation. So there was a lot of work to do. And I think a lot of staff who were working with young people, particularly young people who were using drugs, were worried about what information they could give. And so I think we developed quite a good course for staff covering a lot of the stuff I've already said, but did a lot of stuff around case studies. So actually looking at situations young people might find themselves in and getting staff to think about how could they support young people in that, in those situations.
You're talking about young people, and yesterday you were talking to me about, you were talking to me about sexual health and sexual infection rates among young people, and the link with drugs and cocaine use and so on.
That's right. Yeah, because I think the latest statistic that I read was that in Scotland, 1 in 200 young people under the age of 25 have got gonorrhea. That is huge. That is huge. And although we assume it is related to cocaine use, we don't know for definite, but it certainly seems to be the case. As I said way back when we were talking about the HIV outbreak amongst people who use drugs, cocaine use increases your desire to have sex. And that's what's happening now. So many people are using cocaine in all sorts of different ways. And that means that they're more likely to be having sex, unsafe sex, with more people and therefore at risk. So yes, so that is something else that we talk about, obviously, in our young person's training.
I think the pace of social change as well is really difficult to keep up with for young people. In fact, perhaps for services trying to manage the impact of the of social change in terms of access to things online, how young people interact with each other, the introduction of substances, but not really fully understanding the full impact of what might happen when I do this and how might my behaviour change and my kind of how will my sexual health be impacted by this. And I don't think ever in kind of generational history have we had so much change so quickly for young people. And I think the introduction of social media and the instant access to anything anybody wants pretty quickly has had a big impact on how we respond and try and keep up with all of that. You know, whether it's from a service perspective or indeed from a family's perspective and how to support young people, it's quite the task.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think cocaine use, social media, young people, the three things together. There's a lot of work to be done there to make sure people are safe. So we're thinking about harm reduction, but that they have the correct information. Louise and I did a bit of work with Action for Children and we did some staff training, but we also did some work with young people themselves who are involved with Action for Children. And that was fascinating for us, just learning so much from them. And there was one young woman who was talking to us about the number of sexual partners she'd had. And we talked to her about condoms and she was like, oh no, I would never use a condom. So we got loads of condoms out and we talked about them and we showed her how to use them using our condom demonstrators. And she went away with loads of condoms. Mm. And she said, yes, I will. So it's actually just sharing the information with young people can help keep them safe. And listening to them, I think, is really, really important, especially for somebody my age. I mean, I do rely on Louise. She's very up to date with what's happening with all this stuff. And I might have the background information, but she knows currently what's happening for young people. And I think it's really important to keep up to date with all of that.
That's, I suppose, the wider learning for me from witnessing that stuff has been how behaviour changes, and it takes a while before we understand in service land that there's something going on. Maybe the people we're working with daily, there's a whole aspect of their life can not be apparent until there's an issue mm-hmm. or it's highlighted for some reason. And then government policy, strategy, and then funding eventually, it can be a decade behind that. Mm-hmm. And all of that, we have to tighten all of that up if the world is changing more quickly, our behaviours are changing more quickly than they have in the past.
Yeah. Yeah, and going back to the government's action plan for 23 to 26, the bit that's been added in there is young people services. So a recognition that we need to be thinking about young people. And these are young people who probably are using substances of one sort or another. So it's all linked, isn't it?
Yeah, and then there are a vulnerable group of young people that maybe we get nostalgic about the past and misrepresent the way things were in the past, but a group of people you would have been identified as vulnerable in the past who maybe end up with a heroin problem when there was a smaller range of drugs and perhaps people's trajectories were a bit more predictable. People would have said, well, that person, you know, is vulnerable to developing a drug problem, most likely around heroin, and we know what that involves, and we have the services available, or we have hopefully have some early interventions that we can attempt to deploy or whatever. But that stuff has become more complex, partly because of the polysubstance use as well. Mm-hmm. You're mentioning cocaine, but young people using a whole range of substances, including alcohol.
Exactly what I was going to say, actually. Adrian, what's your sense of the impact on alcohol in this kind of, you know, generation? You hear lots of things about young people now are not quite so fussed for alcohol now that we've got that world of social media where people can take videos and put them online and show, you know, if your friends are under the influence and, oh, I don't want to be seen to be drunk and, you know, all that, embarrass myself online. Is there any sense that that is changing in terms of our younger generation's relationship with alcohol? And are we moving more towards novel substances and cocaine and things like that?
That's certainly what we are hearing.
Yeah.
That is definitely what we are hearing. Although, I suppose, to be honest, people are using cocaine and alcohol.
Yeah.
That's the thing. But I think amongst younger people, there seems to be a movement away from alcohol, but that's just anecdotally me, what I'm hearing, that people are moving away from alcohol and much more likely to be using other substances rather than alcohol. And yes, Austin, exactly. In the past, you might have worried about young people. Are they going to end up using heroin? Well, they're already using cocaine. They're probably not going to use heroin, but they're already using cocaine. And then we've got all of the risks around sexual health and all of the issues around cocaine use, how it just stops you from doing everything else in your life. The things that you would do on a day-to-day basis suddenly just don't become important. What becomes important is using cocaine. So I think things are changing, but that is just anecdotal evidence. I have no other way of proving that, but that's what I'm hearing, definitely. Yeah. And I know I mentioned trans people using iPads, but the issue of gender identity is huge for a lot of young people, and a lot of young people who struggle with their gender identity for whatever reason end up using substances just to survive, really. And I know that workers struggle with how do we support this particular group of young people. So we try and cover that in our training as well. And we've certainly had teachers coming on our training course who have been working with the latest relationship, sexual health and parenthood resource in schools, but need a bit more, particularly around drug use and particularly around young people who are struggling with gender identity. So a really important issue, I think, just to keep up there. And it probably in terms of the government, it comes under young people's services. So just, I think, still talking about that is really important. I wanted to say about just Joyce Nicholson from Glasgow University and I set up Praxis, which is policy research and action around women who are using drugs in Scotland. And we've got together a group of people from academia, but also from third sector organisations and statutory organisations, just sharing information about women who are using drugs of whatever sort. And I think that's been a really useful thing, and that will continue and is open to anyone to join. We meet probably every 2 or 3 months, something like that. But I think we still got so much to learn around women who are using substances, and how do we get, if they need services, how do we get the services right for them? if they don't need services, but they just need support, how do we get the support right for them? And I think that's what that group's really looking at. And we've done a lot of work with the Simon community, with Claire Longmuir there, looking at services for women who are still using, who are choosing to use, and how can we support them to keep themselves safe and think about harm reduction all the time.
Do you want to mention the resources that you have that are going into the National Library?
Thank you.
That's something to be incredibly proud of. You know, that's...
Yeah. It's a very nice way to end your career, actually. And if I just say a little bit about the background of that. So the National Library of Scotland worked mainly with Waverley Care to produce an exhibition around HIV in Scotland over the years. And they interviewed me as part of that exhibition and a whole load of other people. And it is a lovely, lovely exhibition. It's still on in the National Library in Edinburgh if you fancy going to look at it. And when I went through to the opening of that, I met a guy called Graham Hanley who works in the library. And I spoke to him about what could I do with a whole load of resources, which I have gathered over many, many years in working in this field. And, you know, they're physical resources. Nobody will use them apart from me. So what was I going to do? Just recycle them all. So I said to him, is there any way that the library could keep these or whatever? And he said, absolutely. So I took a whole load of resources through a couple of weeks ago, and a few of them he already had, to be fair, in the library, but the rest he took, and they will be kept in the archives of the National Library of Scotland. Maybe no one will ever look at them ever again, but I know they're there. And some of them I actually wrote, which is really very exciting for me. And I must say, when I told my children that, they were like, wow, that is amazing. You've got resources in the National Library of Scotland. I think that's quite a nice way to end my career. Yeah, just wanted to say thanks as well as Leslie and Louise, in the team that I've been working with for the last year. Just wanted to say thanks to Lynn and Jill and Wes and Maribeth and Amir, who's just joined us. Thank you all for all your sharing of your wisdom, for all your support, and for all the lovely work we've done together.
I think we've come to an end of our conversation, Adrian, but I suppose I'm slightly humbled by being the last person to sign off your long contribution and your, not just the Scottish Drugs Forum, but as you've implied in some of your saying, across wider networks than just SDF. So all I can do is, on behalf of, I'm sure, thousands of people, thank you for your contribution, all your hard work, and the significant difference you've made to SDF as an organisation and to a lot of people's lives. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Austin. And I think for me, I have loved working at SDF because it allowed me to bring things that I had learned over many, many years together. I worked in both the drugs field and the sexual health field, and working in SDF allowed me to bring the two areas together. And I have loved it. I absolutely have loved every minute of working in SDF. And so would thank everybody and all my colleagues who've supported me throughout that time. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you for listening to this episode with Adrian Hannah. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like and share it, and get in touch if you have any ideas for future episodes. This is our final episode for 2023, but we'll be back in the new year with more special guests and discussion around drugs in Scotland. Until next time, goodbye.